kind of put those fires out and help these folks, so glad to be here.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Athena Hollins, just started my second term. I represent 66B, which is the northern neighborhoods of the city of St. Paul, and I am really excited to be here as part of the committee. I want to make sure that the capital city gets its fair share in whatever we do, and making sure we're representing, you know, the entire state of Minnesota really well.
Good morning. I'm Nathan Coulter. I have been here, let's see, a week and a half, serving my first term representing District 51B, which is basically the eastern half of the city of Bloomington, including the state's largest individual property taxpayer, excuse me, the Mall of America. My interest in serving on this community was born out of serving on the Bloomington City Council for 5 years and really seeing the changes in how property valuations and just property tax bases have really made things challenging for cities in terms of funding those sort of basic services that we just need to provide. And so I'm excited to work on this committee and hopefully do right by everyone in the state to make sure that we can do the things we just need to do.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Proud member of the class of 2018. We stick together. Anyways,
more pressure.
So, I am John Hewitt. I represent Rosemount, Apple Valley, and now Egan. I am a homeowner, so that's one of the reasons I'm definitely interested in this committee, because I do pay property taxes twice a year. However, I do have another ulterior motive here. Most of you know that since I've been a legislator, I've been working on my discipline of EMS. My concern is in our rural areas, we are not doing a good job at this. The great people that work in it and are going and getting there, but we need to look at how that affects us. So I'm looking at property taxes in a lens of public safety and how we make it so everybody has the means to provide good public safety, good fire, and good EMS, so good police too. And so I it's going to be an interesting discussion on this, because I know what's going on in the rural areas, and we got to figure it out, and they don't have the tax base. So thank you.
Hello, I'm Representative Michael Nelson, and this is my 11th term. I asked to be on property tax. I was on it once before, 10 years ago, and when we did the big LGA makeover, I guess you want to call it, a revision. But it's an interesting committee, and I just figured to do something different.
Representative Steve Elkins, 50B, so I represent the western half of Bloomington. And like Representative Coulter, I was a former Bloomington City Council member for 9 years, and so I've long admired the property tax system and kind of wonk out on this stuff. I actually understand how fiscal disparities works. I asked for this committee as well.
Hi, I'm Sean Haydorn with DFL Research, and I've been with the caucus since 2019.
I'm Kelly Conavati. I'm the House GOP researcher. I've been at the House about 5 years, and this is my second year on property taxes.
Introducing ourselves.
Hi. Sorry to be late, Mr. Chair. My name is Aisha Gomez, state rep from District 62A, south side of Minneapolis, and my third time on property taxes.
Well, thank you. And then we have Faith.
I can introduce myself. Yes. Hi, I'm Faith Prevett. I am the committee legislative assistant for the Property Taxes Division, and I'm also the legislative assistant for Chairless Lagarde as well as Representative Brandt.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone. And as you heard, we have a very diverse group that I think is going to help shape where we go. I am a new chair, and I'm going to tell you that I'm going to do everything I can to do the best job that I can. I'm not going to get everything right, but it won't be because my heart's not in the right spot. And so if I do something wrong, I would just ask for grace, and we'll work through it. When we talk about property taxes, I served on the city council and I was a mayor, and when we're out on the doors, I can tell you that it was the number one, one of the top issues, the rising property taxes across the state of Minnesota. And the question that this body, I believe, we have to ask is, why is that? And I think what I want to do with this committee is get everyone's input, but then peel back that onion for us to make the right decisions with the tools at our disposal to lower property taxes. And I think that's extremely important. And we're going to learn more. I think that it's important that we have House Research help us understand the complexity. I do understand that it's very complicated. And it's I like the Bert and Ernie, to be honest with you, but not everything can be Bert and Ernie. And so we're going to dig into some of the details. And if you have questions, I would just ask that you ask. There is no wrong question, and because it is complicated. And how can we make the right decisions if we don't have the proper information or we don't understand it? So that's who I am, and I'm going to do the best that I can. And so with that, we will start with Ms. Schill.
Good morning, Chair Leslie Gard and members of the Property Tax Division. My name is Kathy Schill, Fiscal Analyst at the House Fiscal Analysis Department. Just a little bit about me. I have worked in a city planning department. I have worked for two state agencies, and then I have come to the legislature to provide services to you. So property taxes at the local level as well as the state level is very familiar. Before we get started, please check your packets for information. There is a set of slides for this presentation that we're about to begin. It looks like this. Mm-hmm. Another document that you have is entitled Overview of Property Taxes. It looks like this. And this document will provide you a whole lot more detail on subject matters that we will be reviewing on the slides. And then thirdly, there are two documents that will give you contact information about nonpartisan staff through House Research and the House Fiscal Analysis Department. The first one looks like this, giving you the names of our colleagues, Christopher Clayman, Jared Swanson, Alexandra Hagler, Sean Williams, Justin Cope, and then the Fiscal Analysis Department. My name, Catherine Schill, and my colleague, Cynthia Templin. The other single-page document looks like this, and it's very detailed on subject matter assignments. If you don't have those documents, please let us know. We will make sure that you do have them. Okay, so as an overview of property taxes, the nonpartisan staff serve the division in a variety of roles. And this slide shows the delineation between House Research and House Fiscal. House Research staff provides for bills and amendments. They summarize bill content, provide overviews and background research, answer drafting and legal questions, and when applicable, conduct modeling of proposed changes in tax law. House Fiscal staff creates spreadsheets to track revenues and budget impacts of current law and proposed law changes. We work with Department of Revenue, Minnesota Management and Budget, and the Legislative Budget Office in the interpretation and analysis of revenue estimates and fiscal notes, and monitor budget forecast and economic updates. All nonpartisan staff also provide confidential services to individual legislators when requested, usually with bill development, budget or revenue information, or other policy proposals. Okay, going to the third slide. For each hearing of the division, committee staff will provide a number of documents important to its deliberations. First, there's a bill summary, and that's a brief on the content of each bill. Revenue estimates, an estimate by the Minnesota Department of Revenue, short DOR, that provides an analysis about how the proposed bill language would change state tax collections or state budget expenditures for property tax relief programs. A fiscal note provides an estimate of administrative costs for relevant state agencies prepared under the direction of the Legislative Budget Office with the assistance of all relevant state agencies. We also have a rarely used tool that's a local impact note that estimates the local government or school district fiscal impact of a proposed change in a legislation or rule. If you have questions on that, please let us know. Budget tracking sheets are prepared by House fiscal staff. In division, the spreadsheet is a summary of cost information compiled from revenue estimates, fiscal notes, and other sources for a single bill or for the compilation of the division report. Other documents include partisan briefs, written testimony, and other information, including studies that are sometimes electronic, so you'll have to watch the email exchange when we provide information for you for each hearing, and other things that can be helpful for discussion. So today's presentation on Minnesota property taxes is divided into six different sections. First, we'll have a bird's eye overview of state and local taxes. Then a brief discussion on criteria for a tax system provided by the Government Accounting Officers Association. A review of Minnesota's property tax system, including tax bases, class rates, and levies. Then a review of state-funded property tax relief programs, including AIDS credits and property tax refunds. And then local sales taxes and tax increment financing. So how much revenue do state and local taxes generate in 1 year? This chart summarizes all the state and local taxes collected in Minnesota for fiscal 2022. The size of the entire pie of tax revenues totals $46.2 billion in fiscal 22. About $34.6 billion, or 75%, is collected from state taxes, and $11.6 billion, or about 25%, is from local taxes. Now, looking at the five pieces of the pie, the light blue section is individual income taxes generating the most revenue at $16.8 billion, or about 37% of the total. The orange area is property taxes at $11.3 billion, or 24% of the total. State sales taxes, the gray area, bring in $9 billion, or about 20%. And other state taxes, including corporate franchise tax, gas tax, and excise taxes, collect $8 billion, or about 17%. And the last skinny dark blue slice is other local taxes, which are mostly sales taxes, generates the remaining 2% at just over $1 billion per year. And how are state and local tax collections changing over time? A quick measure is to look back at income, sales, and property taxes over a 10-year span. The bar graph shows revenues from each of the three big three taxes, income, sales, and property taxes, for fiscal years 2009, 2014, and 2019. Each tax type is a different color: blue for income taxes, yellow for sales taxes, and gray for property taxes. Choose a color and follow the bars from left to right. Notice that each progression illustrates strong revenue growth over the decade for each one of these revenue sources. As these revenues grow, so does the size of the pie in a given year. But there's one thing not easily seen here. The size of the pie of state and local tax collection, as that grows, revenues from these three big three tax sources as a portion of the total is gradually shrinking. In fiscal 2019, the big three taxes were 81.2% of the total. In 2009, they accounted for 83% of the total. And if we look back even further to 2001, they accounted for about 85% of the total. And now I'll turn to my colleague, Sean Williams, who will present criteria for a tax system.
Mr. Chair, are we going to wait to ask questions?
It's totally up to you. You guys want to ask now? We can ask now.
I just have a clarification.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, where are the corporate income tax in here? Is it individual?
That is not part of the big three, so it would be outside of what is presented in this chart.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Liz Lagarde and members, for the record, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I staff property tax refunds, so that's the primary way that I'll be involved in the work of the division. I'm going to talk briefly about some criteria for evaluating tax systems. The goal of this is to introduce some terms and concepts and a framework for thinking about taxes. Some of this material will be familiar to those of you that were in the tax committee yesterday, because we presented the same material there, but we're going through it one more time in the division here. I'd start by saying there's lots of different frameworks that can be used to evaluate tax policy. The one I'm going to be focusing on this first slide is one that was developed by the Government Accountability Office. That's a nonpartisan office of the federal government. It's kind of equivalent to the OLA for the federal government, the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'd say just briefly to start that none of these values that we're discussing here are absolutes. In often cases, they'll trade off with one another. You may choose to place different weight on different of these values, and in different circumstances might choose to prioritize one another. These are the sort of types of things that you might want to be thinking about when you're evaluating property tax proposals here in the division. The GAO criteria are nice because it's three kind of main categories in their framework, so it's a little bit simpler and shorter than some of the other frameworks that are out there. The first one is equity. In tax world, equity might mean it has a very kind of specific meaning. It's a little different than how we might use equity in other committees of the legislature. So there's kind of two kinds of equity we talk about in tax policy. There's horizontal equity, which is that the same tax would apply to individuals with the same ability to pay. And vertical equity, which is that taxpayers with a greater ability to pay should pay more tax. An example of horizontal equity in the income tax world might be that the source of your income should not affect the amount of tax that was paid. So if two people have the same amount of income, the source of income, be it capital gains, wages, interest, other things like that, shouldn't affect the rate paid. And vertical equity is more similar to what you might think of when we discuss equity in other committees. So it's equity between taxpayers with different abilities to pay. The second criteria that the GAO brings about is economic efficiency. And the idea is that a tax system should reduce the economic distortion that's caused by the system. Distortions can reduce the overall well-being by directing resources away from their highest value uses. And so maybe to take an example, if the property tax division were to decide, let's eliminate all property taxes for restaurants. On the margin, that might push a few people more into operating restaurants. An economist would describe that as distortionary. That's not people making a decision based on what they are sort of best suited to do in the economy. It would be a distortionary decision that sort of pushes them in the direction of opening a restaurant. Now, U.S. policymakers may decide that that's a desirable outcome, but there is sort of an economic efficiency loss that comes with that kind of an intervention. So an economist would say that's a deadweight loss. The third value for the tax system that the GAO talks about is simplicity, transparency, and administrability. So tax simplicity makes the system easier to understand. It reduces compliance costs for taxpayers. And it makes it easier for the tax administrator to administrate. In the case of the property tax system, that's both the Department of Revenue and the counties that administer the tax system. When we introduce complexity and a lot of into the tax system, people filing their taxes have to do more work to figure out what they owe, to assess the value of a property and things like that. Another thing is that transparent systems that are simpler, can reduce the amount of uncertainty faced by a taxpayer so they can make a better decision about what they want to do with their economic choices. I'd also mention that the administrative costs often end up falling on both public and private actors. This is maybe a little bit less true in the property tax area than some of the other taxes, but it's still the case that someone purchasing a piece of property needs to know what the property taxes on that piece of property are likely to be, and there's a cost to that time and effort. And a simple, more transparent tax system makes that process easier, save people time and money. The GAO also mentioned that economic distortion and compliance costs are what are called deadweight losses. Those are costs to the system that don't produce any consumer or producer surplus. There's sort of no economic value to those costs. So a good tax system would work to reduce those. I mentioned in here that there are other tax policy criteria that are not part of that GAO framework that I think are worth, that we often talk about in the tax committee. So one is competitiveness, and that is, does the tax system disadvantage Minnesota, the state, in competing for investment and business with other states? That's sort of a value that's outside of the three I mentioned, although you could argue it's sort of similar to the economic efficiency criteria I mentioned earlier. Another one is revenue sufficiency. So does the tax system raise enough revenue to fund state government? And there may be disagreement about what the appropriate level of funding for state government is, but, you know, in general, you want to have enough money to fund state government. That's an important role of the tax system. Another one is certainty, and that's about sort of into the future, making sure that taxpayers can accurately predict what the tax climate would be. This is important in making financial decisions, and a good tax system would reduce taxpayer uncertainty, make things kind of consistent into the future. Finally, there's the compliance or tax gap, which is reducing the difference between the taxes paid and the taxes owed. So this is maybe related to simplicity in many cases, but you sort of want people to pay the amount of tax they owe and to not have uncollected taxes. The last thing I was going to mention as part of this presentation is that if you look at a revenue estimate, and I believe Michelle will be going through these in more detail, but one aspect of property tax revenue estimates that's unique is that the Property Tax Research Division, the Department of Revenue, will score bills based on six benchmarks. And you can see them listed here. There's transparency, understandability, simplicity, and accountability. That's kind of similar to the third GAO one I mentioned. Efficiency and compliance, that's mentioned above. There's equity, both vertical and horizontal. There's stability and predictability. That's also on this slide here. I called it certainty. Competitiveness for businesses, that's another one, and responsiveness to economic conditions. So when you receive a revenue estimate for any bill heard in committee, the tax research division will have sort of gone through and thought a little bit about how that bill might affect these different tax policy criteria. And so it's a good thing for you to take a look at as members to sort of think about, how are these different competing values in the tax system affected by this bill? And with that, I'm going to hand it off to my colleague, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. I primarily staff the property tax and mining tax areas within this committee. And we're going to move on to sort of a high-level overview of the state's property tax system and talk about some of the ways that this committee oversees the structure of that system. So the property tax is primarily a local tax. There is a state general property tax levy that we'll talk about in a little bit. But for the most part, the property tax is levied and collected by local units of governments, so counties, cities, townships, school districts, and special taxing districts. Minnesota's property tax system is a levy-based system, and this means that each jurisdiction will decide how much property tax they need to collect in a given year, set their levy at that amount, and then that levy is then applied to all properties within that jurisdiction based on each property's share of the overall value within that jurisdiction. So although the property tax is primarily administered at the local level, there are several features within the overall system that this committee oversees. And some of the decisions that this committee makes may influence things like the shifting of tax burdens through exclusions and classification, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. This committee also oversees property tax relief mechanisms like credits and property tax refunds, so deciding how much relief to provide and to which taxpayers that relief is provided. There are also things that this committee oversees, like state aids to local governments, that may influence levy decisions and may ultimately reduce levy amounts. One important thing to know about Minnesota's property tax system is that it's actually on a two-year cycle. So in the first, the value of each property is determined in year one, known as the assessment year. And then that value and levies decided in the assessment year are then spread in the following year or the taxes payable year. So slide 11 shows the two-year cycle for property taxes payable in 2023. You can see that on January 2nd of 2022, each parcel property in the state was assigned a value by an assessor. By the end of 2022, all the jurisdictions in the state had set their property tax levies for the following year. In January of this year, the counties will calculate tax rates and spread those rates onto each property in the state. Property tax payments will be due later this year in March and in October for most properties, Ag properties have a second half tax payment due in November. So slide 12 has sort of a oversimplified version of a property tax calculation. I think it gets at a couple of important features of how this tax is actually administered. So at the most basic level, the calculation happens in two steps. First, there's a rate that is calculated, and that's step one. Then that rate gets applied to each property to determine how much tax each property owes in step two. Starting with step one, the rate calculation again starts with that levy. So each jurisdiction decides how much property tax it needs to collect. That levy is then divided by the property tax base within that jurisdiction. And the property tax base is simply the value of all properties within that jurisdiction. There are a couple of different ways that value in this step is calculated, and we'll go over those on the next slide. But for the most part, you can just think of the property tax base as being the amount of property value within the jurisdiction. That calculation ends up in a rate, a tax rate for that individual jurisdiction. This happens for all jurisdictions that a parcel lies in. So it happens for the county, the municipality, the school district, and any special taxing districts. And those rates get added together to calculate an overall tax rate that's applied to a property. And that moves us over to step two. So that total tax rate for each individual property is multiplied by the value. Again, there are multiple ways to calculate that value. And that determines how much tax a property owes. So as we go over to the next slide, just kind of taking a look back at step one there, the tax base is what we're going to look at on the next slide. And there are two different tax bases in the state, and that now. The left side of the slide shows the referendum market value tax base. This is sort of the exception to the rule. We'll start with this one. It's used only now for school operating levies. What's unique about this property tax base is that it excludes a few different property types. So agricultural properties are not included in this tax base. Seasonal recreational properties are not included. This would be like cabins and resorts. And post-secondary student housing is also not included in this tax base. The way the value is calculated within this tax base is pretty simple. It's just the estimated market value as determined by the assessor on January 2nd of the assessment year.
Excuse me. Chair Gomez, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swanson, I wonder if you can, I don't know if there's anyone on the committee that represents an area that has like a lot of resorts or cabins, but I'm interested in the exclusion of seasonal recreational property from school operating levies, and like thinking about if there are communities around the state where, you know, where that's like a big issue for their school. Obviously there are definitely folks on this committee who have a lot of agricultural land, but I guess I'm I think broadly in this committee, I'm thinking about, how it is that we're using our tax tools to pay for public goods and public services for our residents. And just thinking, you know, I'm thinking of the, is it like the Gull Lake region? Or maybe even, you know, some of the areas up north along the North Shore and stuff, where there's a lot of this kind of housing. And can you tell me a little bit about like what that does for those local units of government that are having to rely more and more on the property tax base, and if we make any allowances for helping those jurisdictions out at all?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, maybe just kind of a brief background on this particular property tax base. So it's known as the referendum market value tax base because it used to be used for basically all referendum property tax levies, so all property tax levies that went to a vote. That is not the case for all levies. You know, most levies can just be set by a local jurisdiction without needing voter approval, but there are certain levies that do require voter approval. And when this tax base was originally created, it was sort of meant to be used for all of those referendum levies. That has changed over the years. There's only one type of referendum levy that uses this tax base, and that's the school operating levies. So if a county or a city has a referendum for a particular property tax levy, that now uses the net tax capacity tax base. All that is to say that on the seasonal recreational property issue, sort of the rationale for excluding them from this tax base is that, you know, a lot of these properties are owned by people who don't live in the jurisdictions where the properties are located. And the idea was that, you know, they don't have a say in these referendum levies. They don't get to vote on them. That's sort of why they were excluded from this tax base.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But then, you know, if you think there's sort of like a limited amount of property within every taxing jurisdiction. And so I guess I'm just thinking more about like those school districts where they do have a lot of this property. I mean, I understand, right, that like the people who the tax would be levied against don't get to vote in the school operating levy, but it seems like it might be putting some of our school districts in a just in a more difficult position. And I guess I just want to say, you know, that E12 is what, like 40% of our budget overall. And if you look in like inflation adjusted dollars at this the state portion kind of education funding, it's gone down and down and down since I think early to mid 2000s, and school levies have gone up and up and up, and there's sort of a relationship there. So, you know, and to our chair's point, it's like when we were all out talking to our residents this summer, I think a lot of us heard about rising property taxes, rising valuations, kind of the residential homestead sector being sort of overburdened in a way. And, you know, I know that I feel like I vote on a school operating levy every couple years at this point in my community, and I think a lot of us do. And so I guess I just wanted to, like, lift up that, you know, at the state level, we have under the Constitution an obligation to pay for the education of children in our state. And over time, we have done that. We have done a less and less good job of that. And it's because sometimes it's politically difficult to make the decision, you know, to raise taxes. But if we don't make those hard decisions and use the tools that we have, which are by definition more fair than what our local partners have at their disposal because they can only use the property tax base, we're sort of just pushing that burden and pushing that politically difficult decision onto our local partners. Sorry, I made much the same rant in taxes yesterday, but I just feel really passionate about us in this committee in particular being really serious and clear-eyed about the fact that it's choices in life. And if we decide that we care more about cutting taxes for the wealthy, cutting taxes for corporations than we do about funding the public good, then we're just abdicating our responsibility. And we're asking those mayors and those local city council members and those local school boards to have to go back and back and back to their property tax base in order to fund basic public services. And as we know in government, kids need to be educated, roads need to be paved, there needs to be someone there when you call 911. And if we don't do our job, the locals are going to have to step up and do it, and they're going to have to rely on the property tax base. And we're going to continue to hear from our constituents about that on those unsustainable increases in property taxes. So thank you for your indulgence.
You just did the whole hear of the committee. No, that you bring up really good points, and at the end of the day we have elderly people and people on fixed incomes that are being taxed out of their homes. And it's an issue that's rising to the level of that we do need to peel back the onion and find out what is the root cause. And so that's what we're going to do here, and we're going to learn a whole lot more. So I appreciate that input. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Gomez, having been on a school board, been a treasurer on the school board, and the district was below the average tax capacity of most school districts and a lot of ag, part of the tying together of this is there were farmers that would be paying 5 to 10 times as much
as a person living in town on a referendum and a levy. And since this was based on population and students, the evolution towards having it the same, you know, a house and an acre, made it more, level. Plus, it took away a lot of the contention that we had in our community. I assume that the having rental properties up by the lake, again, those families and those properties did not add any additional students to the school district, and I'm assuming that was part of the discussion. But offline, we can probably get together and maybe get familiar with the size and the components. But I think this was a difficult evolution that got us to that RMV, and it's pretty complex. And I think nothing in this committee will not be complex.
I totally agree, Representative Quam, and to your point is disproportionately, yes, the land value is extremely high in with farming, and they were paying, and that's why there was. So I totally agree with you, and that's exactly what this committee needs to do, is to understand the different aspects of it and come to a decision that, you know, is united. I think we have Representative Hewitt next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Gomez is a proud member of the 2018 class also. She hit it right on the head. Resorts call 911, and they expect an ambulance or a fire or police to come there, and so I guess there goes my reservations at the resort this year, but I really feel that we need to look at this. I'm going to go backwards because I'm not as gifted as Chair Gomez on this, but when we do this deduction, so the levy stays in place, the dollar amount of the levy stays there, but then we deduct the property value, which brings the levy down for this part. Is that how it works? Or tell me what I'm looking at.
Mr. here. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, are you referring to the slide that we're currently on?
Right. I'm going back to the subject now. So it's, but it's a kind of quickly, I don't mean to take a lot of time here, but kind of tell me where these people would benefit. Is it that we lower their property values so their amount that they owe is different, or do we actually lower the tax that's due?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, for the referendum market value tax base, those three property types that are listed on the sort of left-hand side of the screen, the ag, the seasonal recreational, and the student housing, they're completely exempt from the referendum, the school operating referendum levies. So those levies just get spread on a smaller tax base. So these three property types are excluded from paying those particular levies.
So they're totally out of it. Sorry, Mr. Chair. So they're totally out of any of those referendums, regardless if they're for an ambulance taxing district, fire taxing district, or whatever. These three categories are out.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, it's only the school operating referendum levies.
Okay.
So any other referendum levies, whether it be from a county or a city or maybe a special taxing district as well, these three property types would still be subject to those referendum levies.
Thank you for clarification.
Okay. Who's up next? All right. Please continue.
Mr. Chair and members, moving on to the right-hand side of the tax base slide, slide 13. This is the net tax capacity tax base. So this is the main tax base, the primary tax base in the state, and this is used for all other property tax levies. I guess I should say all other local property tax levies. The way that net tax capacity, or the way that value is calculated for this particular tax base, is that you start with the estimated market value that the assessor assigns for the property. You would subtract any exclusions like the homestead market value exclusion or the disabled veterans market value exclusion. And then you would multiply that amount by a classification rate. And this is sort of the key to this property tax base and a really kind of a primary feature in the state's property tax system is this classification system. So we're going to look at some of those classification rates on the next couple of slides, but what these classification rates do is they're able to shift burdens between property types by kicking in a different amount of value into that net tax capacity calculation. So slides 14 and 15 just have a few examples of classification rates of different types of property. It's often said that Minnesota has one of the more complex property tax systems in the nation, and a reason often cited for that is this system of classifications. So these two slides, it's by no means an exhaustive list of all the property tax classifications we have in Minnesota. It's just an example of a few primary classes of property. And it gives you at least an idea of what some of these classifications are like and what some of the differences are between some of the major property types. Generally speaking, classes of property or property types with lower classification rates will pay a lower amount of property tax as a portion of their overall estimated market value. Conversely, property types with higher rates will have a greater share of their value used in the property tax calculation and thus pay a higher tax relative to their overall estimated market value. This committee does oversee what these classification rates are. When changes are made to these classification rates, generally you're going to see shifting in the property tax burden between types. So if you were to lower the classification rate for a given class of property, you would be shifting tax away from that property type and onto all other property types. If you were to increase the classification rate for a given class of property, you're going to be shifting tax onto that particular property type and away from all other property types. Slide 16 shows the effect of all of these classification rates. So this slide shows a sample property tax calculation for five different properties, each with different classification rates, all valued at $200,000. So if Minnesota's property tax system was not classified, all of these five property types, because they're valued at the same amount, would pay the same amount of gross tax. But you can see the effects of classification as the property types with lower class rates tend to have lower tax amounts and a lower effective tax rate, and property types with the higher class rates tend to have higher tax amounts and higher effective tax rates. You may notice that there are two property types on this slide that have the same class rate, so the residential homestead and these seasonal recreational properties each have that 1% class rate, but they have different gross tax amounts. This is primarily due to another feature of the system, which is an exclusion. It's that homestead market value exclusion, which I mentioned on the previous slide, but it lowers the amount of estimated market value that's actually used in the property tax calculation, so it provides an additional benefit to residential homesteads. On slide 17, you can see the effects of classification at the statewide level.
Excuse me, Mr. Swanson. Chair Gomez?
Sorry, thank you, Chair Lislegard. Can we go back to the previous slide? Can you just explain the gross and net things? It's only different for agricultural homesteads, so if you could just walk through that for me. Thank you.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, the difference between gross tax and net tax is the existence of property tax credits. So the primary statewide property tax credits that are available to ag properties, and we'll talk about those a little bit more in the next section.
Good. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can go just back for a second to 15, sorry. There's a 4D class rate that's been the subject of a lot of discussion over the last couple of years. And it would be possible to add 4D onto this chart. Thank you.
That was a comment.
Yeah.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, so this is not an exhaustive list, yeah. But as Representative Elkins pointed out, the 4D property tax classification has sort of generated a lot of interest in the last few years. If you go into your handout, so it's not on the slide, but Your handout does have a page on classifications, and there are some additional classifications listed in there.
Okay.
Page 14.
Thank you.
Page 14 of the handout.
Can you please continue?
All right, so the effects of all this class of the classification can be seen at the statewide level on slide 17. Here you see broad property groups, and the share of total statewide market value for each of these broad groups, as well as the percentage share of the overall property tax for each group. Again, if Minnesota's property tax system is not classified, both of the bars for each broad group would be the same. So your share of property tax would match your share of market value. But the effects of classification can be seen here as you see some types of property that have a lower percentage share of property tax relative to their share of market value. An example would be residential homesteads at the top. And then other property types like commercial industrial property pay a higher share of the overall property tax compared to their share of market value. Slide 18 shows where all of these property taxes go. There were about $11.7 billion in property taxes paid in 2022.
Excuse me, Representative Quam had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was obvious from the previous chart that even though they were both labeled 7%, the property tax portion isn't that about 7.45 or so, or?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, are you referring to the agricultural or
the apartment? On the apartment, there's discrepancy in looking at the scale. It's about just under 7.5. What is the actual delta between the two?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I don't know that off the top of my head. These are just rounded. So I think that the market value share is just under 7%, and as you said, the actual property tax share is just over 7%. So I think the blue line rounded up to 7 and the yellow line rounded down, but it's between 7 and 7.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because of the special treatment that property taxes paid on apartments and to renters is reimbursed back to the renters, I would like to have a little more exactness to understand its relationship. Thank you.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I can certainly get you the exact numbers. So slide 18 shows where all of these property tax payments go. Again, there are about $11.7 billion in net property taxes paid in 2022. So net property taxes, again, is after any state paid property tax credits. Those totaled about $140 million in 2022. So roughly 30% of property taxes go to counties, municipalities, and school districts, respectively. The remaining 11% is split between the state general tax, which is at 7%, and then special taxing districts, which collect about 4% of the property taxes. Every year, the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, along with the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, produce a report on property taxes, and they do a comparison between taxes in all 50 states. One of the features of the report is sort of these rankings of different sample properties in the largest city in each state, along with the same rankings for the same properties among rural cities in each state. So in Minneapolis, the large city used for the comparison, or sorry, in Minnesota, the large city is Minneapolis, and then the rural city used in the comparison is Glencoe. I should mention here that a ranking of one would be sort of a higher tax burden. It would be, the state with the highest ranking in the list, and then the lowest number would be the state with the lowest tax burden. So you can see that generally for homestead property taxes, in both the large city and the rural city rankings, it's pretty middle of the road for Minnesota. Both are relatively close to that to the median value. The commercial and industrial taxes in both rankings are, you'll notice, for the most part, are higher, with the exception of the industrial property, a large city rank. But again, this is a result of the classification, so that's sort of by design in Minnesota that you know, commercial industrial properties pay a higher a share of the overall property tax. Then you can see the apartment rankings as well. Those are a little bit more closely related to the homestead property taxes, and they float, you know, closer to the median generally in these rankings as well. I mentioned earlier that there is a state general property tax levy. This is one. This is the property tax revenue source for the state general fund. The state general tax was established in 2001, and it was sort of part of a broader tax overhaul in that particular year. Currently, the state general levy collects just under $760 million, and of that amount, about $717 million is paid annually by commercial and industrial and public utility property. The remaining $42 million of that state general levy is paid by seasonal recreational property. Again, think cabins and resorts for the most part. There have been a number of changes to the state general tax in the last 5 years. So when the levy was first established in 2001, it was indexed annually to inflation. So that inflation adjustment was removed in the 2017 tax bill. The 2019 tax bill reduced the overall levy amount by $50 million. And then the 2021 tax bill exempted the first $150,000 of market value for the CI portion of the levy. And then there was a corresponding reduction in the overall levy amount by about $20 million to prevent any shifting.
Representative O'Driscoll has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out the fact that the state general tax that we're referring to right now is collected from local property tax owners, businesses, but they've received no benefit in the community as a result of this. This is, goes right into the state coffers on this. So it's the state getting an opportunity to be able to, through local property tax, to get an additional revenue source. And to Representative Hewitt's question before, if you take a look on slide 20 in your packet, or the identified as slide 20, the $42 million applying to seasonal recreational, although the recreational and seasonal don't pay a referendum school tax, they are also subject to this tax. So if you own a cabin or resort property, you're going to end up paying into the state general fund on this as the local property owner, like businesses in industrial wood or commercial wood as well. So you may get a relief in your local property tax for the referendum as a cabin or recreational property owner. You do pay the state of Minnesota for that privilege.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, unless there are any other questions on the state general tax, I'm going to move on to the next slide.
So basically you're saying that the state of Minnesota does not tax residential property?
Mr. Chair, for the purposes of the state general tax, the only property type subject to the state general levy would be commercial, industrial, public utility property. And then there's also this the seasonal recreational portion of the levy, which again is mostly cabins and resorts. There are some other smaller classifications included in that as well, but there are no residential properties that are subject to the state general levy.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, kind of to build a little bit upon Representative O'Driscoll's comments, I think the state general property tax levy was created as part of the 2001 property tax classification rate compression. So the commercial class rates on local property taxes used to be much higher than they are now. In 2001, they were lowered to reduce the disparity between the residential and commercial tax rates. And at that time, in order to collect revenue and avoid having commercial properties get a sudden windfall, the state just stuck its straw in and said, we're going to give you a break on your local taxes, but we're going to stick our straw in and collect some of that and have it go straight to the state. So just the origin of that. Did I get that roughly right, Mr. Swanson?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, that's correct. So that, you know, part of that overhaul in 2001 was the class rate compression. So yeah. The classification rates at that time for commercial industrial property were, I think, 3.4% and 2.4%.
Yeah.
And those were compressed down to 2% and 1.5%.
Yeah.
The other major piece of that overhaul was the repeal of the state, or sorry, not the state, just the general education levy. And, you know, at that time, the state sort of took over more education funding as well. So it was the class rate compression, but it was also the general education levy.
Yep. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Mr. Swanson, you may have mentioned this and I missed it, but are pipelines and power lines subject to the state general tax?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, to the extent that they are, you know, subject to property taxes, yes. There are some, a few exemptions for some personal property that are in statute that, to the extent that they are taxable, that, you know, they would be paying the state general levy.
Representative Anderson?
Was that kind of a yes kind of question? Okay, thanks.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, Representative Elkins, who has clarified my statement, the fact that when the prior to the 2001 changes in the tax code and the tax rates, whether that property tax was at whatever rate it was, that money went to the local governments. Mm-hmm. What has happened is there's been a change in those rates. The locals are collecting less. Mm-hmm. The state of Minnesota has stepped in and said, we'll take that as a part of the general levy. There's not a direct correlation that the dollars that were taken by that tax go in and come back to the communities. The communities have a net loss as a result of that over the years.
Well,
oh.
No. We're just productive.
Representative Elkins.
And Mr. Representative O'Driscoll have a great deal of respect for each other. So when the local class rates were compressed, it represented a shift of the local burden from businesses to residential properties.
Representative Hewitt, it's getting exciting here. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was looking through your packet to see if I'm going to ask maybe a bad question. Are recreational properties, like, are they considered, they have to be a cabin on a lot, or can they be a trailer parked on a lot, or can they be an Airbnb?
Representative, I almost upgraded you, or maybe demoted you. I have no idea. Probably demoted you, took a lot of money from you. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt. So it's not so much, the type of structure that determines whether or not it's seasonal recreational property. So you could have a manufactured home that does get that classification. You could have sort of a log cabin that gets that classification. You could have something that looks a whole lot like a residential property that gets that classification. It has more to do with the use that's seasonal in nature and things like that. Generally speaking, an Airbnb probably wouldn't receive the seasonal rec classification. There is sort of a separate carve out that it's not a separate classification just for short-term rentals, but there's a classification that does include them. But that's not to say that, you know, someone who has that classification, you know, they may rent it out on Airbnb once or twice and it still receives the seasonal rec classification. So it's really more about use, what the primary use of the property is, rather than, you know, kind of what the structure looks like.
Thank you.
Since you brought up short-term rental, I did hear a lot about that regarding fiscal disparities and the increase for 1 year with the misclassification. Is that something that we could talk about on a different day? Is it a bigger conversation, or could you give us the 5-minute spiel?
Mr. Chair, it's not included in the overview presentation. It's,
okay.
It's maybe something that's worth going a little bit more in
depth. I would really like that. It's a big subject. So please continue.
Mr. Chair and members, before we move on to the property tax relief section of the presentation, I just wanted to mention a little bit about mining taxes.
Please do.
Currently, the taconite mining industry pays an in lieu of property tax through the production tax. So the production tax collected just over $100 million in 2022. It's calculated by applying a rate, which is something that is indexed to inflation. That rate gets applied to a three-year rolling average of taconite production in order to determine the amount of tax that is paid. Revenues from the tax are distributed to jurisdictions within the Iron Range that are impacted by mining or historically have been impacted by mining. Finally, the production tax is currently the only in lieu of property tax being collected by mining activities. But once non-ferrous mining starts in the state, so this is non-taconite, non-iron related mining, so think copper, nickel, other non-ferrous metals. Those mining activities will pay a different in lieu of property tax, something called the net proceeds tax, and that will automatically kick in once those mining activities have occurred and they start generating revenue.
Chair Gomez.
Yes, Chair Lisligard. He's like, I don't want you to ask any questions about this. But I did just have two questions quick. First is, I wonder if you can give me a sense of this $102 million in production tax. Like, do we know if the mining industry paid property taxes? Obviously, they'd be subject both to local levies and the state general tax, I would imagine. But do we have a sense of, like, what the difference is in those numbers? Or maybe that's a question for a later time. I'm not sure.
Chair Gomez, part of the reason why they did that is there's so many different communities around there, and there's only so many mines, and we all work there, and we all share. And then that's why it's created, and it goes to the IRRRB and to several different funds where all the communities that support all the different, the six mines, we all get a piece of that. If you were just to go strictly property taxes where one jurisdiction would get it, you would have like three or four communities that would have everything, and the rest of us that work there would get nothing. So it was designed to make it a fairness issue for everyone on the Iron Range, since it's all of our way of life. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, I would just maybe add one thing. Part of the reason that the sort of in lieu property tax exists for mining is that it's difficult to put a value on the property, especially once the mining has begun. You'd be trying to account for fluctuations in ore prices and things like that, and that's one reason that this method is used instead of the property tax, is because it's those prices can be volatile, and actually finding an accurate value for the property itself is difficult to do. So answering that question might be difficult as well because of that same reason.
Can you send us a link?
Chair Gomez?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, well, if there's a way to get an idea of, like, because I appreciate the context that you provided, Chair Lisligard, about, like, sort of the way that taxes from the taconite industry need to be spread over the entire Iron Range. Like, that makes a lot of sense. I am just, if there was a way to, that was easy-ish, I don't know if that's possible. But I mean, to your point about, I guess if you can't establish, or if you can't kind of do a value, if you can't establish valuation on the property, obviously it would be like difficult to think through what the difference in those amounts that gets collected and distributed out to those communities would be under a production tax versus property taxes. But if there was a way, that would be great. And then I just had two other questions. So there's this, did you say that the tax rate per ton goes, it's tied to inflation?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Swanson.
Yes, that's correct. So that 2.892 rate gets indexed for inflation.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you. And so But that's like regardless of what this. So this is basically sort of an excise tax in a way, or well, but that doesn't matter. That's just the way I'm thinking about it. I'm just thinking about like the fluctuating price of this, like, I don't know what you would call it, resource item. You know, like the price of taconite goes up and down, and this tax rate just kind of stays static. It's not tied to the value of the product. It's just to, like, how much comes out of the ground.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, yeah, I think I know what you're saying. So that, you know, the rate is not directly tied to, you know, the value of the material being mined. That being said, I think you could reasonably expect that the amount of material mined is at least indirectly related to the price. So as,
yeah,
as the price goes up, perhaps more material is mined.
Oh, that makes sense.
Okay. And it may be accounted for sort of implicitly.
Chair Gomez.
And then just one last thing, I guess, because I was just, I don't follow the, you know, all the mining news, but I'm sorry, I'm going to try to do better in the future, Mr. Chair. But I just was hearing about, you know, a mine that I think people were like expecting to be producing taconite that was not because of certain kind of market forces. And so I'm just wondering, like, what's the impact on, you know, Chair Lisligard's communities when one of these, it's sort of like, is there any insulation for them against the sort of vagaries of the taconite market, as maybe, like, you know, demand goes down and then production goes down, and then, like, these folks, like, basic services are all tied to that kind of, like, fluctuation and the choices that, you know, giant multinational corporations are making about whether to be, you know, mining taconite here or mining another product somewhere else.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, so that, you know, the main way that sort of that volatility is smoothed out is through the
three-year
rolling average. So,
you
know, the taxable tonnage, that 35.3 million tons on the slide, is really a three-year average of taxable tonnage. So using that, you know, does attempt to sort of smooth out some of the volatility in the tax base.
That's all. Not so bad.
And it wasn't so bad, but no, seriously, I would no, I'd love to sit down and dig into it with you so you understand. Yeah, we'd love that. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will not belabor this point. It was actually just on Representative and Chair Gomez's last point. It's really hard to do a direct correlation between consumption, because this is what you have coming out of the ground, because there's economic forces. One year you may do 20 tons, and the next year you may do 80 tons, and that's going to have a direct impact on the amount of tax that's collected. So with property taxes, they're much more predictable because they're levied, and if we have in the state of Minnesota, foreclosable lien on those properties, if not. And so here you don't see the fluctuation in the value of real estate. I mean, there is, but the property taxes are pretty consistent. Here it's clearly a production and consumption. The more you produce and is consumed in the market, the more tonnage that comes out, the more revenues that come out. Poor economic times, less demand in the marketplace on that, so that is an unpredictable source. And my final comment, Mr. Chair, is perhaps we should be bringing Chair Gomez into our discussions on school trust lands. She may benefit from those as well.
We'll definitely bring her in on that. And that is why it's a three-year rolling average, right? And that's critical. If it went year by year, then we could not, you know, it'd be very dramatic one way or another. So the three-year rolling average is what levels that out. So, but I definitely want to continue that conversation. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, next we will move on to the property tax relief and state aid programs portion of the presentation. So there are a number of ways that the legislature provides for property tax relief. We'll highlight a few of them in this section. We're not going to cover everything, but we'll kind of touch on some of the big ones. So slides 23 and 24 show the fiscal year 23 appropriation for some of these property tax relief programs. They're sort of listed in terms of you know, the cost in order of largest appropriation to smallest, at least for the the state aids and credits, the direct payments to taxpayers, so those property tax refunds are broken out separately at the bottom of the chart. But you also see on the far right column the recipients. So where does that money actually go? Where does the spending go? So even though you see some of these are paid to local jurisdictions rather than directly to taxpayers, they are still considered property tax relief, as you know, they're likely holding down property tax levies in many cases. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through them, but the sort of the primary way that property tax relief is provided directly to taxpayers is through the property tax refund program, which Mr. Williams will discuss in a few minutes as well. So the largest state aid for local governments.
Excuse me, Representative Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, if we can go back to the previous slide on here. The committee had, during their introductions and others, some comments about rising property taxes. And on slide 24, you'll see the relief programs for renters and ag and homestead on here. What I'd like to have, if we can, just a quick high-level conversation from staff to tell us about how the property tax credit program works and renters program works, because there's two circuit breakers, as I understand it. You apply for your regular homestead credit, and then if your property tax have gone up under certain conditions, or there's been a spike in that, there's a secondary relief program under the property tax relief program in Minnesota. And I'm also curious if that's an open appropriation or how we handle that in our budget.
If it's okay, we're not going to finish today. And so if we can come back and then have that conversation, would that be okay?
Mr. Chair, only bringing it up because it was a topic that members talked about out of the chute.
Yes.
So maybe they can sleep better tonight knowing that the state does have a program in place to try to provide relief for them. It's your call.
If it's brief.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, there's a whole section on property tax refunds coming up. So.
Oh, there we go. See?
Mr. Chair, stay tuned. You're going to have some nights, I guess. So.
Mr. Swanson.
So moving on to slide 25, the largest state aid to local governments that I just mentioned is the Local Government Aid Program, or LGA. LGA distributes just over $564 million annually to cities, and it's the largest source of general purpose aid to cities. Just a little history of this program. It dates back all the way to 1967, when a portion of the newly enacted state sales tax was dedicated for property tax relief to local governments. The revenue, you know, at that time it was more of a revenue sharing program, but it transitioned into more of a true state aid in 1971 as a part of the Minnesota Miracle. Since then, there have been a number of changes to the program in terms of the jurisdictions that receive money from LGA, to how the funds are distributed. But I believe someone mentioned earlier that sort of the last major reform was in 2013, and that sort of largely brings us to where we are today within the LGA distribution formula. So there have been changes to the appropriation amount since then, but the formula used to distribute LGA last went through a major update in 2013.
Representative Elkins.
Real quick, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is that some work around this tweaking the formula was done last session, that it wasn't implemented. But, you know, what were the nature of what was being discussed or, you know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, in last year's House tax bill contained sort of an update to the formula. The formula in that bill was sort of the result of similar work that was done in 13, where a variety of factors that determine need for cities within the formula were analyzed, and sort of the main factors that influence need within a city were determined based on that analysis, and the formula was updated to sort of reflect these new factors that might be determining need within cities.
Okay.
Representative Elkins,
you just want if we would want to pick up that work this year and do something with it. I would like to learn more about it as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, will do. Please continue. Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe not, Chair.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to be like some sort of sketchy question, but I was just like I was outside. I was going into a meeting yesterday and. I had a lobbyist for my city, I believe, or he was sort of advocating on behalf of my city to me about LGA and said something about like like we are in 2002 or 2003 maybe, like I don't know if he was saying that the overall amount of LGA distribution was like higher than it is today, or he was talking about my city's allocation of it being higher than it is today. But, you know, obviously this just goes back to 2013, and I wonder if you can take us, you know, 15 years earlier than this and kind of tell us if that overall amount was similar to this or less than this. Or...
Mr. Swanson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, so historically the, you know, the sort of peak appropriation in the, in terms of the overall amount for LGA was in 2002, and that's at the same level that it is now. So in nominal dollars, the 2002 appropriation for LGA is about where it is now, but that person may have been referring to inflation-adjusted dollars and it not being the same.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So like in 2002, 20 years ago, it was at about 564 or so.
Mr. Williams. Representative Gomez, that's correct.
Okay, and that's just right there, you know, if we want to talk about something that's driving up property tax levies in our communities, you know, having a lot's changed in the price of everything, I think, in the last 20 years. And so, you know, again, not to repeat myself over and over again, but that's like, that's decisions that people in our seats made then, that basically have been driving more and more spending on the public good onto the property tax levies, which is related obviously to, you know, what is happening in our constituents' lives right now. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the tax chair. We on this committee can come together and correct the errors of the previous legislators that have developed this simple tax system that we've got for property taxes, and we'll all work together for fairness. So we've got your back.
Kumbaya. Well, we have another meeting in this. Okay, the guy in charge just said you get about another 7 or 8 minutes. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, perhaps maybe a good place to stop would be after the LGA slides. So there are three more LGA slides, and that's maybe a good stopping point for today. So as I mentioned, LGA uses a formula to determine aid amounts for all 854 cities. So all cities are within the distribution formula. In 2023, 742 cities will actually receive an LGA payment. 112 will not receive any LGA because of what was the amount determined by the formula. So the reason for this is that the formula attempts to determine each city's need and then compares that need against the city's ability to pay. And you can see that on slide 27. This is sort of a maybe just a high-level example of how this formula works. So need is determined by a variety of factors that differ depending on the size of the city, depending on the city's population. And ability to pay is the city's property tax base multiplied by a statewide average city property tax rate. So if the city's need exceeds the ability to pay, so if that number is positive, that means it has unmet need and it will receive a portion of the LGA distribution. If a city's ability to pay exceeds the need, the city's determined not to have any unmet need according to the formula, and the city does not receive any LGA for that year. There are other features of the LGA formula that we won't dive into too deeply today, but I did just at least want to highlight some of those need measures. So I mentioned that depending on the city's size, how need is determined varies, and you can see the factors for each of the three city types, so small cities, medium cities, and large cities. Each has a different way of determining need, the formula has a different way of determining need for each of these three groups. Mr. Chair, that's the last slide on LGA, and perhaps that's a good place to stop for today.
Chair Gomez.
I'm sorry. Chair Lissigard's getting annoyed with me. He gave me a look. So I'm just looking at the density measures
So if you have population density of less than 30 people per square mile, if you're a small city, 150 people per square mile, if you're a large city, then you get extra money.
Mr. Swanson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, I would maybe phrase it a little bit differently. Okay. I would say that you the formula would say you have higher need. It doesn't necessarily mean that you would get extra money. It depends on the values of the other factors, and it also depends on your ability to pay. But I think the rationale behind that is that if you imagine a city that's sort of less dense and maybe more spread out, that compared to its property tax base, it might have.
I can tell already that this is going to be a major homework assignment.
Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, these small city, medium city, large city designations, I assume those specific numbers are in statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Swanson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Coulter, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. I think folks who live in St. Peter might be surprised to learn that they're a large city.
Well, I think we'll end there, but there is a lot of good information here, and yes, there's a lot of work to be done. And I believe that I did hear that about 4% of the budget, state budget, used to go to aid to counties and cities and so on and so forth. And I believe it's right around 2% now. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. That is what I heard maybe 2 years ago. I would have to check and see, but knowing that there's not been a whole lot of change other than federal stimulus, all those kinds of money. If you would allow me, I'll provide more detail when next we meet.
Thank you so much. So with that, it was very enjoyable, good conversation. We learned a lot, and we will continue. So meeting adjourned.